This is Eleanor speaking. Welcome to episode 3 of the Evo podcast, a podcast where CEOs get to share their stories from how they got an idea to making a profitable business. We hope this podcast will enable aspiring entrepreneurs to find inspiration and tips to get started. Today, I welcome Leonard Dollister, founder of Peak. Welcome, Leo.
Thanks a lot for having me. Great to be here.
We're really excited to have you on board. So how are you today? Would you like to tell me a bit about yourself?
Yeah, like you're saying, I'm the founder of Peak, and we've been building Peak now for the past two and a half years. Actually, the initial idea is much older already. It goes back to 2017, where we co-initiated another company that is the incubation company of Peak in the end. And we then spun out Peak in a management buyout in 2020. Yeah, and since then, working on that full time. Peak itself is a Web3 network for the machine economy. So we're working on building an infrastructure to enable people to build applications such as electric vehicle charging or car sharing or like ride sharing, something like Uber, with the difference that it's not central, like there's no central company in between, like Uber, for example, but that all of those interactions and transactions between machines and individuals can happen peer-to-peer. So kind of cutting out the middleman and therefore reducing costs and also decentralizing the control, ownership, and value generation of what we call the economy of things or machine economy. So this is, in a nutshell, about me and what I'm working on and, what we're working towards.
Okay, thank you so much, Leo, for this. You mentioned decentralized application, decentralized also finance on your website. Is it always that you don't have a middleman or you don't have a centralized company? Or how does decentralized finance work? And why did you have this idea? What was the idea behind it?
Yeah, that is correct. Like essentially, when talking about decentralization or Web3, it's all about having like a digital infrastructure, right? We know digital platforms like Facebook and so on, but all of those are, which is also called Web2, those are they're big companies that provide that infrastructure, that platform, and that service. And Web3 is really all about having the opportunity to interact and transact in the digital world on the internet, just without having those big companies. So those are like so-called decentralized platforms or decentralized networks that enable people to have to build these decentralized applications that do not run on the servers of a specific company, but they run decentralized all over the internet. And regarding decentralized finance, this is like one of the first biggest use cases of that technology where people can actually, like in the most simple way, they can send money or value to each other without using any bank. But they can also invest and provide capital and make money, like earn interest from it or getting a loan without having to go to a bank. So there's currently a financial system being built that works without traditional banks as we know it today. This is one of the big use cases of Web3 as of now. And we are leveraging also decentralized finance for our ecosystem in order to have like the economics aligned and enable the stakeholders to earn money and incentivize the different parties to actually participate in making the shift towards that Web3 machine economy.
In Peak, how did you found it? So you had a company before and then the idea kind of emerged. Can you tell us what were the first minutes, the first hours of the birth of Peak? Can you walk us through that?
Yes, sure. So we co-initiated in 2017 a data company called Advanced Blockchain AG. And because we were like working in the space on different projects here in Berlin, like end of 2016, 2017, the early days. And then we met some more people, or like the early investors as well, into Advanced Blockchain AG. And they basically said, hey, well, this is amazing. And provided also the initial capital so that we could actually start working and building. And back in 2017, we already knew that IoT is like, there's a massive potential for IoT plus blockchain, but we also knew it's going to take a lot of time. So we kind of had the initial idea for Peak back then already, but we haven't started working on Peak like intensely or properly before 2020. But what we've done between 2017 and 2020, well, I mean, we've tried quite some things. We did also some project-based things, some consultancy, some investment, because we also needed to understand what makes sense to build. So we worked with a couple of big companies such as Audi and so on to like really figure out what are the use cases, what are the problems worth solving. And that really helped us in shaping our understanding of what the problems are that can be solved and that have to be solved in that context of IoT and machine economy. And furthermore, also understanding what are the core functionalities needed to create a successful Web3 or blockchain infrastructure to serve these use cases. And then, like 2020, we knew like, okay, more or less what we had to do. What we then still did is we also built some private networks because most companies weren't ready or willing to use an open permissionless network, which is a network that is run and governed by a community and where you need a token. And most companies are like, yeah, or were really skeptical of tokens and crypto. But that has changed. There's still a lot of skepticism, but it's much, much better. So many companies are actually embracing the technology now and really see a lot of future potential in it. One company that even has that in their future strategy very intensely is Bosch, for example. They say like the economy of things is going to be decentralized, and they really say, hey, there needs to be an infrastructure that is not run by a few big companies like AWS or Google. They have their cloud offerings for IoT, but it needs to be decentralized and permissionless. And yeah, like being in touch and like getting to know a lot of those things, we then also knew, because it was always the plan to decentralize what we're doing. But then finally, since last year, we are like on the journey of building that open permissionless network, really open sourcing everything we're doing, and yeah, creating the ecosystem and community around it.
Leo, how did you turn Peak from idea to reality? What were the first steps to get there?
Yeah, that's good actually to look back and think about that, because I think it's always like a process. And as I said before, so we started this other company or co-initiated it, and we had like early investors who said, wow, you guys are an amazing team. So I met like one of my co-founders, and you're already from back home where I'm coming from. Then the other one we met in Berlin, and then there were two more people that we worked with at the time. And these people said, wow, you guys are an amazing team. We also want to go into that space and invest and build a business there. And we then initially already had the idea of Peak, right? But we, as I said before, also we tried different things. So we had some funding in the beginning to get going. And then we also created revenues, project-based a lot in the beginning too, like where we consulted companies, where we did proof of concepts and demonstrated use cases like decentralized charging, for example, with Audi. And we then got more investors on board. So we did a initial funding or like a funding round there, who also believed in us as a team, believed in our capabilities to work with these big companies, and trusted us to actually productize what we were doing back then in a very good way. So we got them on board. One of them was Michael Gunzer, the former Cisco Europe senior vice president. So he was leading Cisco in Europe, and we got more and more great people on board that also invested in us early on. And then there came the time in 2020 where we're like, okay, now we really know what we want to do. And the other company was developing more into like a holding investment company, raising more capital to like invest. We were like, okay, we know how to productize this machine economy network. And that's when we spun out Peak as its own entity. And we took larger parts of the team that we have built up back then with us. So besides the initial team, which was five, and then and two also were not with us then anymore, but that we as the three co-founders were all still there. And then we got new people on board as well. Then we did another angel investment round after the MBO to have initial funding within Peak, which was great, from strategic angel investors. Then we did another funding round afterwards. You could call it kind of the pre-seed round last year, where we got more investors on board because we could show like the traction we had with industry and the bigger projects we were working on, and that we have like a clear strategy on how we want to create a decentralized platform out of that and what the value is for those investors in terms of tokens and equity. And then just 2 days ago, we announced our latest funding round, which can be seen as a seed round, but it's mainly for the public network, where we collected funds from more Web3 specific investors that are interested in the token and really focused on the entire decentralized network. And that just happened now. So of course, since we're building something long-term and something very visionary, we really had to build up trust. And I think lots of the investors that invested in us, they were investing in the team and the vision, but also in the traction that we had to show. For example, we signed an MOU for mass production with a big automotive firm and so on. So we really had some like clear results that we could show paired with the vision and the strong team. And that's how we mainly finance ourselves. And of course, we made revenues along the way, these bigger companies, but the revenues are not enough to build everything we want to build. So it's a very capital intense project. And we also will raise more money going forward. Yeah, but this is like in a nutshell how it started. And it was really a process. We started running. We were resilient enough to keep going. And that made all the difference because we could have stopped many times along the way.
You mentioned health. Do you think you would have done things differently? Or do you think that it was necessary to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day sometimes? Do you think you should have done it differently? Or it was just a way to go because you need to secure your place, you need to understand it, to have your products as quickly as possible ready for the market at the right time?
Yeah, I do think it's extremely important to work very hard and as hard as you can, especially when you're starting. But definitely with my knowledge now, I would have done many things differently. For example, I haven't done sport for a year, and that was very, very bad because of course you take like maybe overall 3 to 4 hours a week that you can't work, but they have such a positive impact on the time you're actually working. I also slept way too little. So there are many things, and was running on caffeine all day long. So many, many things I have learned and I would do completely different now. I would still like try to work as much as possible without sacrificing balance, because I think there's a sweet spot. Like you can only work so much and you need a certain amount of balance time for sleep, sports, good nutrition, spending time with friends and family in order to be overall healthy and have good amount of well-being, because only then you can be as productive and as creative as possible. And this was really, this I would do very different now. And this is what I'm trying to maximize right now, or since a year, like really having the best possible amount of well-being and then having as productive working hours and working time as possible.
What is your typical day like? What would you, you know, start working on? How do you organize yourself? Obviously, it's not 14 hours per day anymore, I guess.
Yeah, true. Very true. Yeah, that's a great question because and a very important one, because I think it's all about the daily routine that actually enables you to work and live sustainable as an entrepreneur. And so I usually wake up around 7 in the morning. Then I usually go for a walk, maybe have a coffee, listening to an audiobook. Then I meditate, do like a very little bit of yoga, get ready, shower. And then afterwards, I have something in the morning called a makeup block. So there's a famous article by Paul Graham, which is called Maker and Manager Schedule. So he divides the work, like any creative work is maker work. That's how he calls it, where you need many hours to dive into a problem, edit something, code, conceptualize something. And then the manager block is where you have calls, answer Slack messages, answer emails, and so on. So in the morning, I have my maker block. So I try to focus on one big value-generating task in the morning that requires multiple hours of focus and attention. And then I also try to not check my phone, no messages, no social media, nothing, to have a very calm start into the day. And then at 12 p.m. usually, I check my phone, I answer messages, and I actually start having calls, start replying to emails and be available for the team on Slack and so on. But this really helped me to make progress on the important big tasks while still being able to communicate and not block anyone. And before I had that routine, I often had the problem of not having enough time to actually work on the big things. Because if you want, you can spend the entire day on Slack, emails, calls without a problem, especially as a founder. And this often leads to not making enough progress on the product side, for example. And yeah, then in the evening, I try to actually sometimes, like on the day I do sports, I try to do it during the afternoon so that I work before and work after sports again. And then the evening, trying not to eat too late because it affects sleep in a bad way, and aiming to sleep around 10, latest 11, so that I get enough sleep, because getting enough good sleep made the biggest difference for me in terms of creativity, productivity, and well-being.
And tell us about your team. Did you have the same team from the beginning? How did you recruit them? How does the team look like now, 5 years later? Well, kind of 2 years later, but still they were founding members before, I guess.
Yeah. So the team changed a lot. We started, some very early team members are still on board, which we are very happy about, like especially when it comes to core developers. This is super crucial because they have such a crucial role in terms of knowledge and understanding. But generally, the team changed a lot over time. We have 14 nationalities, which is pretty cool. So we started recruiting also from all over the world to tap into all kinds of talent markets. We became remote first about a year, 1.5 years ago when COVID hit and anyone had to work from home anyway. So yeah, we have, for example, someone in Malaysia, someone in Nigeria, someone in Peru. And this is fantastic to have so many cultures coming together. Yeah, I mean, the founding team is the same. I think that's, of course, most important. But then we hired a few amazing senior people in the past couple of months, because as we grow and scale, we also realize, of course, we need more senior expertise, things that we cannot necessarily cover in the founding team. So to strengthen the overall management team, we're definitely looking. I mean, we have fantastic international diversity. We're working on also getting a bit more gender diversity, because in the space we are, and generally software development, it's a bit more difficult here and there. But yeah, overall, the team is fantastic, wonderful, kind, hardworking people.
How did you manage to distribute tasks within yourself? So if you think mostly the initial team, you know, when you have the idea and you start thinking about the mission and the vision of the company, how do you divide tasks among yourself? Do you just look at skills, or do you just say, well, I actually like doing this, so I'm going to do this? Or do you all take on whenever you can?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I think initially we all had their natural strength, or it was more or less clear what they shall focus on. For example, for Till was clear that like fundraising, he's into investing a lot, and like building the relationships with investors and so on, this really makes a lot of sense. Then for Max, communications and marketing, that was also clear. And for me, having like a technical and business background and understanding like product is really what made most sense. And then, of course, so there's this general divide between responsibilities, but you do a lot, especially at the beginning, right? Everyone does a lot of everyone. Everyone does a bit of business development, doing all kinds of admin tasks that have to be done. So I would say in the beginning, it was really whatever has to be done needs to be done and divided. And then we, of course, have our responsibilities. And as we grew and now we're able to have like hire more people through having more resources, we then really started to define responsibilities more and more. For example, I, for a long time, taken care of business development and product development, but it doesn't go hand in hand so well because business development is very much lots of communication calls, emails, messages, and product development is very like inward focused, right? Like thinking about strategies, ideas, requirements. You need a lot of time where you think and you are not distracted. So this is now being split and I'm giving that completely away, the business development part, because yeah, it doesn't make sense.
So these are really useful tools. Have you ever like seen other parts of the job where you actually can't mix and match different tasks? Like have your colleagues seen this too? So, say for example, you have one person who's in marketing and the other one in development completely, or I don't know, one is just doing some management and then they see they also doesn't work with another part of it. Have you seen all of those incompatible tasks?
Yeah, I think more like what you mentioned, marketing or communications and software development is tough to mix, I guess. I mean, there are very technical founding teams, and then they can also do some marketing, but often doesn't end too well because if a person is too technical and thinks too technical, it's often difficult for them to make things in an easy, understandable way, which is needed for investors and the public community or like customers. So I think, yeah, engineering and marketing is not so compatible. It can, of course, there are always exceptions, but it's a bit more difficult. For example, if you're doing fundraising, this is often a full-time job and requires a lot of effort and focus. And then if you do fundraising and, for example, taking care of operations, all the operations, and the operations are like 20 people plus, for example, it's also super difficult. So we also got a, like 10 months ago, we got a head of operations on board, because we all realized we don't have enough time to take care of operations properly if we are all like caught up in our like core responsibilities.
I'm interested in knowing, how do you troubleshoot these things? You seem to be quite aware of the like problems in the company or where things don't work at some point. I think that's very interesting. How do you decide on these things? Like, do you meet up or every week you give each other feedback, or do you just somehow notice and at some point when it becomes too much, take a decision to make a difference, recruit somebody else or split tasks differently?
Yeah, very, very good question. So what we do is, of course, we have like a weekly meeting, a management meeting to like work through a list of problems or like points to discuss, so that we align and bring them up. That is very helpful. Then, of course, as the founders, we also discuss a lot between us on a daily basis or also on a weekly basis or with specific meetings and calls, so that we are aware of what issues there are to be solved. And then we think about, okay, how can we get them actually solved? Also distribute ownership, who's responsible for solving this? And then it's often also in the past, many things you cannot solve, or often you cannot solve things immediately. Yeah, unless it's not smooth. But sometimes problems are like have to be solved over a certain period of time in our experience. And then we develop a strategy on how do we get from here to actually having that problem solved. And it often takes some time. But yeah, eventually you'll get there.
And is Peak already live? Can people already build on it? And what is basically your metric of success?
Yeah, so we have the testnet live, so people can build and test it out. So it's a test network, which is completely public. And there's also documentation, which is will be updated very, very soon, so that people know how to interact with the network. And there will be two production networks. One will be towards the end of the year, the other towards the beginning of next year, likely, because the market conditions also have changed. So we will wait a little bit longer until we launch those production networks. But as I said before, building is possible already today. And our main metrics of success is really kickstart the peak ecosystem. Like the ultimate goal is to have like a decentralized ecosystem with many different stakeholders and community members that are using the peak network, that are developing the peak network further, that have interest in it doing well, so that eventually we as the initiators need to kind of make ourselves obsolete, because the term of a DAO or decentralized autonomous organization, like you hear it every now and then, but this is really the goal of having a decentralized organization that is kind of a community developing and using the network going forward further. And of course, there will be a token. So there will also be a token price. So the token price or the market cap of the network will reflect how successful it is. Because long term, the more it's being used, the more it's being leveraged, the more the token will gain in value, and that will reflect in the market cap. So I don't want to take the market cap as the ultimate measurement of success, because there are many more things, but it will be a hard number in the future of measuring where we stand, or like seeing if there's a lot of interest and usage of the network actually.
If you become obsolete, what are you going to do?
So start the next thing. So it's building like a decentralized network is different to a traditional startup. And a traditional startup, you exit at some point, right, or an IPO. And then you as a founder could either lead the company long-term, or you leave the company and you build something else or take some time off. And with a decentralized network, the token, for example, is tradable. So as a founder, you'll also be able to sell some tokens or other assets, so that you earn money, you have an incentive, a financial incentive. And your goal is really to create a healthy ecosystem and community that then develops itself further. And then you can still be involved in leadership, thought leadership, and guidance. But the goal should be that such a network is not dependent on one, two, or three individuals. And I think that is very different. And there's, of course, no exit scenario where you're like, okay, now I sell this network to Microsoft, because that's the whole point of it, right? This network is not supposed to be owned or controlled by anyone or by any individual company, but really by all the stakeholders that have a share in it, that have tokens, that are using it, that are contributing to it.
But by having those decentralized application, decentralized finance, does it mean that the quality of the product of the use actually varies a lot with the partner that is actually producing this compared to large companies?
Yeah, that is correct, definitely. I mean, many of those apps are built kind of and maintained by communities. They usually start with a team. And then the beauty is that everyone can join and contribute. And companies, for example, that want to use this, or individuals that want to use this specific service, they can actually get involved, because it's all open source. So they can co-create and co-shape the project, because the idea is really that there is no one owning and controlling it alone, but that everyone who has an interest in using it can actually get involved. So it's not really, you're not having to rely on one specific company, but it's really a community. And of course, like the higher quality a project has at its foundation, the more likely it is to attract high quality community, meaning high quality contributors as well. And then in the end, this will very likely lead to the best possible product to like cover this specific use case.
To make sure that PEAK is being used and useful, do you yourself sometimes picture yourself as a user from PEAK, and what kind of application would you think of? Or do you always look from the other side?
Yeah, no, for sure. We are imagining quite a lot on how it would be to use it. This is one of the biggest tasks and also challenges, because we have a community which we can involve for feedback. And this is also, we will soon have like an incentivized test that it's called, where we will generate a lot of feedback from the community. But I think it's absolutely crucial to see yourself as a user to understand, okay, what shall we build? What does make sense to build? And then you, of course, need to validate your assumptions with your community, with users and future users. Yeah, we are also active in consortia research and development consortia, for example, within GAIA-X. GAIA-X is like a European initiative to create data sovereignty, data ecosystem in Europe. And there we get a lot of requirements from companies, universities, other startups. So we like really try to get as much input as possible from existing and future users, so that we can build the network accordingly to the needs of the user section.
Have you ever missed your target? Like, did you always get enough feedback that you were never off? Or did sometimes you realize, oh, actually, no, I'm not on target, or we've done a mistake, we haven't understood the user's needs completely?
Yeah, absolutely. We had several moments where we started developing in a certain direction, and then realized after some time, well, that doesn't make sense at all. So like we wanted to try things out. And then, yeah, completely threw it away, kind of. Like, we're like, okay, no, this doesn't make sense. Also doesn't make sense to invest and spend more time on it. We need to change strategy on the product side. So we had that. We had like one bigger change in that regard. And yeah, I think that's very important. It's good to try things out, to iterate quickly, and then ideally reach a point where the direction you're moving into makes sense and where the feedback is then really positive. And I think now we have that. We found that like we get a lot of positive feedback for what we're building and the direction we're walking in. Also from investors, community, and partners. But yeah, for sure, we had that multiple times.
Do you reckon there's a foolproof way to actually make sure that you don't invest too much time in the wrong direction? Like, for example, feedbacks, obviously, but you might still have to go quite further along. Or do you reckon there will always be a moment where you have to develop and you just have to test and crash, and it's only when you fall down that you realize that, you know, it was the wrong thing? Is there any magical foolproof way to prevent entrepreneurs to go too far on their developments?
Yeah, I think the foolproof way might be is like, of course, doing research in the beginning, analyzing the market, and then building something based on that knowledge super quickly, like very short period of time, very low budget, as cheap as possible, like what people call an MVP. But an MVP is often seen as a first product version, but an MVP actually is really just the minimal thing you need to get some feedback, and then like do this within a couple of weeks ideally, and try to get feedback on that from investors, from users, and so on. And I think if you stick to that, like, and really just build the least possible, like not too much functionality or features. And if you do this and then iterate based on that feedback, I think this might can be called as a foolproof way. But of course, it also depends on your experience, on the understanding of the market you're in. If you're very young and you're entering a new market you haven't really spent time in before, I think it's very difficult to get things right from the very beginning, and you might need some iterations. But if you manage to do this on a low budget, then yeah, I think that could be a foolproof way.
Good thing to know. So you mentioned before that the market has changed a bit. I guess it changed a bit during COVID. But what are the main changes at the moment? So because of the war in Ukraine, or what changes do you see also in technologies that make Peak more or less useful to the community?
Yeah, so I mean, what COVID has done for sure is, I mean, first of all, changed the way everyone works, which was a positive change for us to enable us to be remote first, hire people from everywhere, not only build a decentralized network, but also work in a decentralized way. Then I think it has boosted digitization a lot. So software companies or companies that are building solutions on the internet definitely got a boost. And I think it also helped us to a certain degree and the entire Web3 movement, as also people then want to make money on the internet from home. And you can do that a lot on Web3 when you perform certain actions and services. At the same time, so much money got printed, right? We have lots of inflation. We had an intense upward trend, even though the economy was suffering and supply chains are suffering. And like the effects are coming now. And then the war didn't make things better, right? There's a lot of fear. It also is affecting lots of supply chains, especially food supply chains, sanctions with Russia, which affects energy, and that makes everything more expensive. So we are now entering a seriously difficult time in terms of economics. I'm pretty sure the next 2-3 years will be tough. There has been a lot of funding and venture capital in the markets, or there is still a lot of money to be invested, which helps startups, but this will decline more and more now. And for us, it was also, we just raised a round and was more or less just in time. So we are happy that we are set to build in that difficult time going forward. But yeah, it's going to be no joke, I think, the next years when counting together all the things, the macroeconomic things that are happening, inflation and a shortage on supply chains. But yeah, for anyone building in the internet, I think there's a lot of opportunity, and also for all companies that are starting now or will manage to get through the crisis, tremendous opportunity to hire great people, to survive a difficult time that many competitors might not survive. And many great companies were born in the last recession or economical crisis. So I'm pretty optimistic, but one has to be cautious as an entrepreneur.
Perfect. Leo, thank you so much for this wonderful insight into Peak, but also into how you yourself became an entrepreneur, what were your challenges. It was really wonderful to have you today.
Thanks a lot for having me. It was my pleasure.
This was Eleanor Pauly interviewing Leonard Dorluchter from Peak. We hope you have learned as much as I did today, and we look forward to welcoming you in episode 4. See you next time.